Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, Chair of the Club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and the Chair of this program. And now it is my pleasure to introduce Phil Wexler, Master of Library Science at the National Library of Medicine, to introduce the moderator, Chris Bowman.
Okay, I'm glad apparently none of you were too frightened by the title, Poisons in the Press, to come here, even in the rain. All right, there's no getting away from chemicals. We're routinely exposed to them in our homes, workplaces, schools, indoors, and out. Indeed, we're compounded of chemicals. So they've got us, chemicals have, coming and going, and being so integrated with us and integral to us, it's no wonder we're fascinated by them. But chemicals, in and of themselves, are neither good nor bad. Context is really everything, and context can be quite complicated. Although many chemicals can be beneficial and even necessary, others, and curiously enough, sometimes the very same ones, may be hazardous. We'll talk today about poisons, a highly charged and ultimately subjective word, and safety, a concept which is just as difficult to pin down. Our program will take a two-pronged approach to exploring ways in which you can become better informed about the potential hazards of chemicals. One, by examining some very basic concepts of the science of toxicology, and two, by observing how scientists and the media interact, highlighting successes and failures in presenting you, the public, with information. As such, we have a highly distinguished panel of toxicologists and journalists, and a highly skilled and experienced moderator. There will be ample opportunity for you to ask questions, as Bill mentioned, or voice concerns, and we really encourage your participation. So I'm going to show you two opening slides which demonstrate the range or spectrum of stories you can expect to encounter regardless of the way you take your news, whether you take it on paper, audiovisually, digitally, plugged, wireless, stationary, or mobile. From what I call the heart-wrenching, and this is coming out of Voice of America earlier this year, lead poisoning rampant among Nigerian children, rights group says. Thousands of children in northwestern Nigeria are in urgent need of treatment for lead poisoning. New York-based Human Rights Watch says dozens of villages in northwestern Zamfara State remain contaminated 2 years after the problems were first discovered. Left untreated, lead poisoning can be fatal. And you see periodically stories like this that can really tug at your heartstrings, and a lot of these problems are happening in the developing world, but not exclusive to the developing world. And then this can go to the other end, to the lurid. I have nothing against Florida. Coming out of the Miami Herald, though, suspects in toxic tush case plead not guilty in court. And this happened. Two people accused of injecting a toxic mixture of fix-a-flat and superglue to enhance women's tushes arraigned Monday on charges of practicing medicine without a license. Okay, so this is the other thing you have to deal with. And if you factor in things like air pollution, contaminated toys, adulterated dog food, recalled drugs, drugs of abuse, oil spills and their cleanup, venomous and poisonous plants and animals, food poisoning, and so on, you begin to get a sense of the scope of this issue. And I'll just say this morning, from my own experience, I mean, I woke up in the hotel, I put on NBC News, the very first thing I heard is about nitrate pollution, and Chris had actually alerted me that this study was going to come out from UC Davis. They were talking about serious problems with nitrate pollution in California, Central Valley, in the farming communities. So I go downstairs for my breakfast. You know, I pick up the San Francisco Chronicle, and I'm sitting and reading in a coffee shop a front page. They're talking about tiny frogs spreading this killer fungus. It doesn't affect them, but it's decimating other frog populations. And inside on the San Francisco Chronicle, there's another story about L'Oreal, the French cosmetics company, and going into some collaboration with the U.S. EPA with the ultimate objective of reducing animal testing, and apparently they're going to share for 20 chemicals their year's worth of animal tests that EPA is going to use to calibrate against computer modeling system they have called ToxCast. So I thought that was that, and I came back, and on another table in my hotel is the Wall Street Journal. So I pick that up, and on the front page, I'm in the elevator, and there's an article on fracking, hydraulic fracturing, in which they're pumping water and sand and chemicals into the earth to get natural gas. And this happens to be saying that, well, in effect, it may not be the fracking itself that's causing the water contamination, but really the wells. There have been failures in the cement, the problems with the wells. And, you know, I go upstairs. The TV is still on. The TV is still on, and I hear the tail end of, and this is all true, the tail end of something, and I don't know exactly what it was all about, but about silicone leaking from breast implants in Paris or France, something recent. I mean, we've heard this before, but I don't know what this particular thing was about. So you think, I mean, are we going to hell in a handbasket or what? Or why? What should we do? What should we do about it? Is this a problem or not a problem? This is what we're going to discuss today. And the people that will discuss it, and you have their bios, so I'm not going to go into big life histories here. But and if you could please raise your hand when I announce you, Linda Birnbaum, who's Director of National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences and Director of the National Toxicology Program. John N. Cardona, Supervisory Research Toxicologist, Northwest Fisheries Science Center. Kent Olson, Medical Director of the California Poison Control Center. Marla Cohn, Editor-in-Chief of Environmental Health News. Jane Kay, San Francisco-based environment writer, and Janet Railoff, Senior Editor for Science News. And this is being moderated by Chris Bowman, who's Chairman of Environment Energy News Initiative, Capital Public Radio. And I think this is where I will hand it over to Chris. I did want to mention one other thing that I neglected, too, which is, as an aside, the U.S. Society of Toxicology is holding its annual conference here in San Francisco, a few blocks away at the Moscone Convention Center, and toxicologists are presenting original research to thousands of their colleagues. And at their meeting, they're addressing some of the very same issues we're going to be covering this afternoon, albeit in considerably more depth. Chris? Mercury and seafood.
Yeah, well, thanks for that uplifting intro. The take-home message is really just don't read newspapers. That's mine.
What newspapers?
Yeah, what newspapers is another issue, which we will be discussing. Actually, I'm going to come around here, if the microphone will allow me, and sit down. If I can undo some of this. Actually, maybe I could sit here and make it a little bit more casual. So this is terrific. I have to tell you what a pleasure it is to be with these panelists, because I've known and in some cases worked directly with some of them, and I've known all of them throughout my career in reporting, which spans 30 years. But I have to tell you, you'll be hard-pressed to find a more dedicated group, both from the journalist point of view and toxicology point of view, dedicated to that subject. And let me tell you, on the journalist side, which is where I come from, trying to maintain that beat, particularly in these days of journalism, is very, very tough. So it's a real treasure to have them all here in one place. So the whole idea here is, as we were musing over this panel, is we came to realize that one thing we all have in common is we have to deal with the public question of, well, is it safe? And, of course, anyone who answers that directly, yes or no, is not doing their job. It's never a straightforward answer, and we'll talk about why that is and how we get at the information we need to know, both as consumers and just intellectual, curious people. We're going to start with the example of seafood, and rather mercury in fish. And you probably won't see this slide from where you're sitting, but basically you have a few stories saying it's good for you and others suggesting it's not good for you. For example, and this is all within a few months, the past few months. Eating mercury, here's one headline, eating mercury-tainted fish affects essential stress hormones in children. Adding fish to your diet, though, will help your heart. Salmon can help arm you during flu season. Go ahead and eat fish. Harvest of Fears, farm-raised fish may not be free of mercury and other pollutants. Don't eat fish. High level of mercury found in hair of Japanese whaling town residents. Maybe I don't eat fish. Eating fish may be good for brain health. I want to be smart. I'm going to eat fish. And it goes on like this. And you know the story. You could substitute fish with wine or coffee and, you know, pick your poison, I guess. So what I wanted to get out here first is we're just using fish and seafood as an example that you're all familiar with, but we want to bring out several points here. But before we get started, I thought I would ask Jane to kind of give a rundown on the issue of mercury and fish, just to give us a quick primer.
Mm-hmm. Well, mercury and fish is a terrific example of what we're talking about. Because on the one hand, you have seafood. It's rich in protein. It's full of omega-3 fatty acids, minerals, vitamins. It's low in saturated fats. There are hundreds of studies that show the benefits of eating fish. Everything from lowering the risk of coronary death, aiding the brain function. And so we know that fish is very good for you. On the other hand, the mercury in the fish is a potent neurotoxin. It's so damaging to the fetus that it can impair intelligence and reasoning and behavior in a child that's exposed in the uterus. The messages in the media are so confusing, as Chris pointed out, that some people come away with a black and white opinion. Either they're saying the benefits outweigh the risks, and so I'm just going to eat fish, and I'm going to give my kid a tuna sandwich every day. And others say, oh, it's way too scary, I'm not going to eat any fish. But scientists are telling us that we have to have a nuanced approach to how we deal with fish in our diet. And there was a study produced about 5 years ago by the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Sciences. And what it clearly said is that the balance of benefits and risks are different for different populations. And each population gets different advice. And so the advice is for everybody to eat salmon, sole, sardine, shrimp, anchovies, herring, all these fish that are very fatty, but they're low in mercury. And the advice for women who will be pregnant, who are pregnant, who are nursing, for if you're feeding children up to the age of, say, 12, is to stay away from swordfish, shark, king mackerel, and limit most tuna. And some mercury researchers advise that these sensitive populations stay away from tuna altogether because you can't really tell how much mercury is in it unless you have a lab nearby. And so that's where we are.
So if you're running a hotline or a poison control center, how do you handle calls like, should I eat tuna? Should I eat sushi? I'm asking this first of Dr. Olson, who is director of the California Poison Control Center. Do you get questions regarding fish and poison?
We do. I'd say more commonly the questions regarding mercury have to do with broken mercury thermometers.
Okay.
And how to clean them up. But we do get the occasional question about mercury in fish, and we try to dance around the question and try to answer it as best we can for the individual involved. Pretty much recording the kinds of things that you've said, which is it's potentially harmful, large quantities, but eat small amounts, it's good for you. Can't hear me?
Maybe just push it closer to you. Perhaps.
How about now?
Yeah.
Okay. Just by way of background, the Poison Control Center in California takes about 300,000 calls a year, about 1,000 calls per day. So we're dealing with usually acute emergencies involving a rapid risk assessment. Has somebody gotten into something that's immediately dangerous to their life or health? Do they need to go to the emergency department right away? And the questions of lower dose chronic exposure are not as familiar to us. So we do the best we can with those kinds of questions, and we look to those who are more expert in the long-term environmental low-dose exposure world to guide us. But we often find ourselves giving information that we feel probably confuses people a little bit. You know, we say, yes, it is potentially toxic, but fish is good for you, and eating in the right quantities is probably fine.
Marla?
I think the issue is that the advice that should go to consumers is to pick your species well. You know, when you eat fish, you should eat lower on the food chain. The smaller, the younger the fish, the better. Things like anchovies and sardines are low in mercury and have a lot of the nutrients that we need. But I also think it helps a little to talk about the risks of fish. I mean, mercury in fish when a fetus is exposed. Because what the studies have shown, and a lot of this is based on studies in the Faroe Islands, where children have been monitored for about 25 years, the effects on them when they were exposed in the womb to mercury actually in pilot whale, which is higher on the food chain than most Americans eat. But the difference between the highly exposed children to mercury and the low exposed was about 7 IQ points. And you can say that doesn't sound like much. But it actually is pretty much a whole school year in these 7-year-old children. They were losing enough IQ to be equivalent to almost a whole school year. And what that does is that means more kids in special ed, more kids needing remedial attention. And so that's the type of effect you might have. But, of course, eating fish also brings benefits to the brain, the developing brain. So what we really need to get across, and the press doesn't do a really good job of it, is, you know, a pregnant woman really should be eating fish to a certain degree, but you really have to pay attention to how much and which fish you eat.
That brings up, and I'm going to get to you, Linda, one of my not-so-favorite editors at, when I worked at the newspaper at the Bee, who would ask if I was doing such a story, well, could you let's get some victims' voices into this story. Go find somebody who has a low IQ because of mercury, or if you have high particulate matter. Well, you're saying that, 3,000 people die prematurely every year in California because of diesel exhaust and other contributors to tiny particles in the air. Please go find somebody, so make the story more believable. Why can't that be done? Take it away, Linda.
Well, I'm going to address a couple of points
okay.
there. First of all, it can't be done because some of the effects we're looking at, you really can see on the population basis rather than on the individual child. We've known for years, for example, that prenatal exposure to lead is a problem. But I can't talk to you, Chris, and say, darn it, you know, Chris, if your mom had a little less lead, you would have had 3 more IQ points. I mean, you could never pick that up. You have to look at the
high chair tipped over, but another story.
You know, but you have to look at the population issues for these kind of things. It's not things that you can pick up on an individual. When we have a air pollution episode, for example, and there are a lot more people going to the hospital because they're having respiratory problems or heart attacks or asthma attacks, you can't prove that their asthma attack was because it was a bad air day. But statistically, you can see it. So that's a challenge. You could take something like with the kind of mercury poisoning you get from fish, which is totally different than the mercury coming out of the thermometer, you know, the things that many of us as kids, somebody would bring in a thermometer and you'd have this little silvery ball that you were busy pushing around with your finger. I mean, maybe that impacted us too, but anyway. But the point is you could go to Japan where there are high levels of mercury in the fish and actually contaminated a fishing village. And the pictures of the impacted children from that village are terribly, terribly painful. And my colleague Phil Landrigan from Mount Sinai School of Medicine often shows them as an example of what can happen. I mean, you saw the picture of the children who were being poisoned by lead in Nigeria. I mean, you can get the similar kinds of severe poisoning, but that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about low-level effects that are hard to identify in the individual, but have major effects when you look at the population as far as costs. So the point I wanted to talk about methylmercury in fish a little bit is that it's the kind of fish that you eat, as Marla said. You do want to eat lower on the food chain. You want to eat younger fish. But we have to be very careful because those nice, fatty fish, some of them might not have mercury, but they might be loaded with PCBs and perfluorinated compounds and flame retardants and some of the other goodies. And unfortunately, the messages that we're getting, you know, don't discriminate. So there's lots that comes out, don't eat this fish because of the mercury, but salmon is very low in mercury, but it's really, farm salmon is really high in some of these persistent poisons that we deal with. So that doesn't mean you shouldn't eat fish. You eat young fish, you eat small fish, you avoid, say, eating the fatty parts of fish if you can, and you learn which kinds of fish, for example, don't have a lot of these things. So tilapia is usually, and I'm just using that as an example, has relatively low levels. If you're going to have tuna, have the chunk tuna instead of the albacore white tuna.
The light instead of the white.
Right. For example, is lower in mercury. So, you know, I usually say to people, all things in moderation. Now, I know there are lots of college kids, or at least used to, subsist on, you know, their protein source was tuna fish every day, you know, a can of tuna. You know, that I think is problematic today.
Can you address the mercury versus methylmercury for the audience? Because you brought that up.
Sure. Well, methylmercury is when mercury, say in the thermometer, gets into the environment, it goes, gets into the environment, and it gets, it becomes an organic form of mercury, which means that a carbon atom is attached to the mercury. And that happens through bacteria, and it also can happen in the fish. So what's in the fish is the methyl form, which we know is not only affects your brain development, it also affects your immune system, okay? And that, but the inorganic mercury, that's the stuff that made Isaac Newton a little bit crazy. You know, it wasn't only that the apple fell on his head, but it's that can actually cause adults to have impacts from the inorganic form of mercury. So there are two kinds of mercury that can be bad for you, the inorganic form, which in many ways is more of a concern. Well, it's a concern for everyone. And then the methylmercury, which is really most of concern during developmental exposure. But that's what you get from fish.
Janet?
Yeah, another issue is the fish that have been described so far on the panel here are the ones, marine fish, the ones that the feds go and measure mercury levels in. In fact, most lake fish, especially in the Midwest where I come from, are heavily contaminated with mercury, and almost every state has a mercury advisory suggesting how little fish you should eat, and probably almost none if you're a pregnant woman or have young children. But in fact, you know, sport fishers eat fish all the time, and they aren't told. I mean, none of these guidelines give, you know, you much help in terms of figuring out which freshwater fish to eat, how much to eat, which lakes are preferentially bad, and why. And there's a lot of science to explain which ones are riskier than others, but that message is a little too nuanced and a little too localized, so it doesn't tend to be sent out via me and others who are looking to give a central message to the masses. In fact, you're not the masses, you're individuals, and so the message should be tailored for you, but it's really hard to do.
The California does have a system where they do post-consumer warnings.
Right. Yeah, local fish advisories.
Right, and with various levels of effectiveness. It was only in recent years that they realized, oh, maybe we should have it in languages other than English, because if you're a subsistence fisherman, you're more likely also an immigrant, recent immigrant, whether it be from Southeast Asia or Ukraine or you name it. I see them every morning because I go rowing out on the Deepwater Ship Canal in Sacramento, and they're there every morning, the same characters, fishing, and Some may be to sell to their neighbors or for small markets, but it's probably also going to feed their family. And we're talking about striped bass and bottom feeding carp and that are likely to get more bioaccumulation of the mercury. Well, I don't want to pick on fish all day here. I like to spread it out a little bit to get to the broader question of uncertainty. There's few absolutes when it comes to environmental contamination, and it's I've always struggled to describe in stories relative risk. I feel uncomfortable saying, well, it's the equivalent of smoking six packs of cigarettes a day if you're not a smoker, or six packs, what am I saying? But, you know, just, I can't find an analogy. I struggle on this sort of thing, and I'm sure my colleagues do as well, whether you're a toxicologist or a writer. But perhaps we can just start with defining one of the guidelines for uncertainty that many of you may have heard called the precautionary principle. Linda, do you want to speak to that one?
Sure. The precautionary principle, at least my definition, and the definition that is used in much of the world, is that it's not that you act in the absence of information. It's that you act in the presence of some information that causes you to have concern. There's never certainty about anything. You're never going to know everything about something. And so the precautionary principle says is that when you have information that causes concern, even though you don't know everything, even though you're not sure it's going to be a problem, you would act. It doesn't mean you would do something when you know absolutely nothing. And unfortunately, that message has often been, I would say, perverted to say, oh, the precautionary principle means that you ban everything, even if you don't know anything about it. That's not what it says. The precautionary principle says if you have concerning information, you take action in the presence of knowing everything.
So how do you deal with questions like, well, okay, I don't want to subject my child to unnecessary risks, but I'm driving my kids to school every day. Accidents can happen. I have to make risk decisions, insofar as whether my kid's going to wear a helmet or not, or the car safety seat, whether I put that on, there's all kinds of decisions we make day to day on risk. But when it comes to these environmental contaminants that we can't see, smell, or hear, how do you communicate that? And maybe we can give for example, from one of the journalists here on how you convey the idea of relative risk. Anyone want to take a shot at that? Well, how about let me.
Well, let me.
Yeah.
Explain.
I mean, in some cases, it
boils. You want a particular compound?
Yeah.
When we write about things, part of the problem we run into is we don't have unlimited space. So increasingly we are writing shorter, and an average story for us is 400 to 500 words. You can't get into a lot of detail. You certainly can't get into a lot of nuance, quotes, that sort of thing, numbers, caveats that are important in 400 to 500 words. So you try and take the statements that convey generally the line you want with maybe a little comment here or there. It gets very hot. Risk is a very nuanced thing. The one thing I try and get across to my readers is that nothing is safe, okay? It may be safer, it may be riskier than something else, but nothing is totally safe. In our hearts, we all know that. So then you have to sort of decide, well, when are you going to act on something that is potentially a risk? Because everything is potentially a risk, and we don't want to be paralyzed. My job as a news person and science writer is to tell you sort of the cutting edge stuff. So I'm going to be reporting stuff that Linda was doing in cutting edge research on, and others, where it suggested there was a risk from cell studies or animal studies or whatever, but not human studies. What do we take home from that? And it's really hard to know what to take home from that except think about it. be cautious. We can't tell you that it's dangerous. We can't tell you that it's safe. Most people want to have that answer. Is it safe or is it risky? Because you only have limited space and RAM in your head, right? You can't go and keep everything there waiting for a conclusive answer. You want to store it away in long-term storage that it is safe or it's not. And we're telling you, as journalists, that no, you got to store everything in RAM because it's going to change. That what we know about it is always going to change. And if you don't like it, too bad. That's what life is like. And that's a message that the public doesn't want, but we fight to, with our editors and with our readers and our listeners all the time to get that point across. There is no certainty. In the absence of certainty, we can't be paralyzed either. We've got to live. And so you know that it's dangerous to cross the street in the middle of the block, but you're going to do it. To, you know, turn on a red if you're not really careful, but we do it. You had a glass of wine and you got in the car and drove anyway. There are risks all the time, but you try and minimize them and be smart about it. And as more data come in and things look riskier and riskier, then I think you act on it. But what it means is we need to pay attention all the time. And if we read or hear that something is risky, then start paying attention and look for more of it. We've got to be educated consumers. And that's, you know, not what most people want to hear. They don't want to have to do homework. And we're saying we do homework and you're supposed to do homework too.
Sometimes some of the difficulty is, you know, you have the medical community saying
here is a wonder drug and this is the best thing ever and thousands of people are taking it and 2 years later it's recalled. How is the public supposed to react to that? What can journalists do to present this kind of news? I mean, they're putting their trust in the, medical profession.
You want that?
Well, I was just going to say that every story I write, because I cover environmental health, every story has gray area. There's rarely a story where I can say there's a cause and effect, that you have this exposure, you're going to have this effect. That happens virtually never. And so I have to write the stories to convey that to people. It might be we have lots of animal data that these low doses might be risky, but we really have no clue what it might mean for human beings. So I could say that for virtually every story that I write. But then again, you also have to get across why people should care then. Like when we were all started writing about flame retardants 10 years ago or so, chemicals called PBDEs, they were doubling in human breast milk in this country every 5 years. We didn't know what the effects would be, but these PBDEs were very similar to chemicals called PCBs where we did know the effects. And so is that a good thing that it's gathering, it's collecting, accumulating in the breast milk, doubling every 5 years? I would think most people would say no, even if we don't know the effects. So if you can get that across to readers and write about the uncertainty of, no, we don't really know what it does. We're just starting the animal testing now. We don't have any human testing, and eventually it was starting to catch up. It just takes time to do these studies. But get across to the public, this is what you're being exposed to, and we really don't know what the effects might be, and that's where the precautionary principle might come in.
And those who took the precautionary principle, say, back in the 70s, when in my neck of the woods, Sacramento, there was vast contamination in neighborhoods surrounding Aerojet in Rancho Cordova, Aerojet, where they manufacture rocket motors, including ones that sent the Apollo missions and other NASA flights, and it's still in business making rockets. Well, for many, many years, they routinely disposed of the used rocket propellant, whether it was liquid or solid, right in the dirt, which was even past the point where you weren't supposed to be doing that anymore. Bottom line, high levels of perchlorate, an ingredient of solid rocket fuel, in the drinking water, and the state agencies at the time decided not to monitor it because they didn't know anything about it. There was no evidence that it caused any harm. Well, it turns out there's a very direct correlation between levels of perchlorate and thyroid disorders. You know, that's where the precautionary principle paid off in one example. I want to ask a question about animal studies, because there's a lot of distrust, I think, that I sense among the public when you have stories that emphasize the evidence based on mainly either lab studies or laboratory animals. And, you know, what do I have in common with a mouse or a rabbit? But first I want to turn to John. What you do a lot of studies on marine life and toxicity of marine life. How are some marine creatures particularly good sentinels for our own human health? How do you draw that link between what's happening with a creature with fins and us creatures, you know, with two arms and two legs?
Well, you
justify yourself.
Yeah. I think the biggest challenge is, you know, it may be related to people's view of evolution, right? I mean, if everybody believed as firmly as most biologists do that there's this high degree of conservation among certainly all animals with backbones, I mean, even animals without backbones, it may not be such an issue. And before I even talk about fish, if you think about it, if you look at it, a lot of the chemicals that have turned out to be things that we're really concerned about. I mean, you go back to Rachel Carson in Silent Spring and the DDTs, right? That was all studies in birds. BPA even. You know the reproductive effects of BPA were not discovered in the natural environment, but it was discovered in mice living in an engineered environment of a plastic box. So one of the compounds, earlier in my career, I worked on a natural compound in plants that causes horrendous birth defects, yet the pathway that's disrupted by that compound is also active in some tumor types. That chemical has now been the lead compound for developing new anti-cancer drugs for tumors for which there were no chemotherapy. That was discovered in range animals in the Rocky Mountains. Right. So in a lot of cases, chemicals are first picked up in animals because accidents. I mean, a lot of it is serendipity. So that conservation is really important. You know, most people think fish are, I mean, in many ways they are extremely different. They don't have lungs. Yet their heart is actually more similar to the human heart. A bluefin tuna's heart is actually far more similar to ours than a mouse or rat. And a lot of the studies that are looking at cardiotoxicity of compounds are done in mouse and rats, and our suspicion is a lot of things are missed because they're actually physiologically different enough in significant ways that you could miss things.
Hmm. Okay. Anybody else want to jump in? Yes, Linda.
Yeah, I'm going to have to jump in.
Okay.
Which is, I totally agree with what John just said about the point about that nature is inherently conservative. Once nature figures out a system that works, a certain kind of enzyme, another kind of protein, a certain gene sequence, it tends to use it over and over and over again. So that we find out that many basic pathways of health and disease are present not only in fish, but are also present in little teeny worms or even present in yeast, and we can learn a great deal by studying them. I really try to remind people, people are animals, and most of the people who are studying, say, rats and mice, are not studying them because they're inherently interested in the rats or mice. They're studying them as models for health conditions in people. And in fact, there's usually a great deal of similarity. What we tend to forget is that, people are different. There's a great deal of variability in response across the human population. So, only 11% of smokers ever get lung cancer. That doesn't mean that smoking doesn't cause lung cancer. It means that some people are susceptible and some people are not very susceptible. And it's the same thing with rats and mice. So if you want, and Jeannie has heard me use this analogy before, if you want a rat that has breast cancer, I've got a rat for you. Every rat in this strain is going to develop a breast tumor. You want a rat that doesn't get breast cancer? I got another rat for you. None of those rats are going to get breast cancer. Now you ask me, which of those rats is representative of people? Or of the human population? And the answer is both.
Hmm.
And I think that's something that we have to think about, that if you see something, say, happening in an experimental animal model, it could be rats, it could be mice, it might be tiny little roundworms called C. elegans, it might be fruit flies, okay? It might be fish. It should perk up your interest. Could this kind of thing be happening in people as well? And what's been very, very important with a number of studies recently is there have been animal studies that have suggested there might be a problem. Nobody ever asked, did those chemicals cause a problem in people? These were, quote, safe chemicals. And when they began to ask the questions, they began to see that, in fact, there were effects that could be associated with exposures, for example, to BPA or to phthalates or other things. And it can go the other way. We see something in the human population that we never saw in our rats and mice. I mean, the tragedy of thalidomide, which many of you know about, caused phocomelia, which is basically kind of flippers for arms and legs. And it theoretically was supposed to prevent miscarriage. It had been tested in, I forget if it was rats or mice, and they hadn't seen it, that it caused an adverse effect. It turned out if they'd looked carefully, they would have seen something. But this was back in the 30s and 40s when they first used it. And then you had this human tragedy. And then you went back and said, well, how did this happen? The other point would be you take something like thalidomide, which during development causes terrible birth defects. It's a very, very potent chemotherapeutic agent that can be used against cancer. So that when a chemical is biologically active, what happens is going to depend upon the who gets exposed and the when that gets exposed and the how long that gets exposed. And all those are things that it is complicated, but that's the reality of biology. Probably more than you wanted to know.
Well, thanks. Before we open this up to this discussion up to all of you, I wanted to pose this question to anyone on the panel here. I'd like you all to get some pointers from the experts here as to what sort of things you look for when you're reading a journal article, when you are concerned enough that you actually go to scientific journals, and how to critically read them to decide for yourself before you turn the story over to millions of people how much weight you're going to give the story or whether it's a story. What are some of the signs of the strengths of scientific studies and some of the red flags?
I can give a very cynical answer to that.
All right. I'm into cynicism.
You look at the funding source, right? I mean, honest to God, you know, depending on where the funding came from, that's where a lot of the opposing views. As, you know, an environmental scientist that works on oil spills and things like that, our job is to determine what the effects of the oil spill were, and the other side, their job is to, you know, make that effect not so bad so the company doesn't have to pay as much for it.
All right, well, let me play devil's advocate.
Just because
it's, say, industry sponsor doesn't necessarily mean that.
No, it doesn't. But, no, like I said, that's a cynical answer.
But, right. It's just. Is anyone here a cricket?
Yes.
Oh, I use the same one as my alarm clock. The same cricket sound, so it particularly alarms me. Am I awake? Okay. Really, I use the crickets. Yes, Janet.
Well, another thing you look at is what kind of dose has been used. And what we really like to ask is, was it an environmentally relevant dose? So if they've used a dose that's like 4,000 times what anyone would ever get in their lifetime, you've got to wonder, what does that tell you? Maybe it did make an animal sick, and maybe it did make it sick quickly, and maybe that's the way to get an answer without waiting a long time. But some things don't work the same way all the time. And the other hand,
Linda's going to comment on that.
It's hard to know what is an environmentally relevant dose. And so you try and ask the question, but in some ways, while you're trying to cover yourself by being clever about it, sometimes there is no answer, and you can almost give people a false sense of security if you make it look like it wasn't environmentally relevant when that's not material.
I think we have to be very careful. I agree with you. Is it environmentally relevant? But a little mouse or rat often has to get at least 100 times higher dose, you know, given to them than a human. I mean, the smaller animals get rid of chemicals much more quickly. So to have the same amount in your body, like the same amount circulating in your bloodstream which is the appropriate measure of dose, you often have to give a little more. I remember some fellows at our institute were the first to show that arsenic in drinking water could cause tumors in mice. That had never been shown before. We knew that arsenic caused tumors if you inhaled it in people, but here they showed that drinking water caused it in mice. And the way they did it was they gave it while the mice were pregnant. So it was the pup that was exposed before it was born that then went on to develop tumors, okay? Well, this study was slammed by some people. They said, oh, well, the concentration in the drinking water, I think it was about 20 parts per million, is so much higher even than they have in the areas in Bangladesh or Inner Mongolia where you have a lot of arsenic poisoning. That's true. But the concentration in the animals when they measured it was lower than the concentration that occurred to some people in Bangladesh or West Bengal in India or Inner Mongolia or the American Southwest. You know, so you have to be careful about, is this a really high dose or is it just appear to be a high dose because you're not measuring the right, you can't compare animals and humans by how much they breathe in, how much they drink in their water. You have to compare what's in their bodies.
Which means you should ask, is it an environmentally relevant exposure as opposed to dose, because then you can look on a per cell or tissue basis?
I think you have to say, what does this mean for me? Does this, what appears to be a very high mountain drinking water or a high air concentration, what would this mean for me as a human being? And I think if you just initially said, well, I'm going to divide that by, let's say, a factor of 10, that'll help you initially make a determination. But more and more studies are beginning to measure how much is in the blood of the animals, how much is in the blood of people, or, you know, other.
But some of those issues are the nuances, though, that are really hard to get across to the lay public in a 400-word
Yeah, you
article,
can't do it in a 400-word.
But the journalist could say, you know, while this may seem to be a very high dose, it actually results in a similar amount of compound X in the animals as are present in some people in our population. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the point that needs mm-hmm. to come across, because otherwise it gets twisted to say, oh, that's totally irrelevant, doesn't mean anything.
Mm-hmm. But it's also, it's also scientists are partly at fault, because what you have to really be careful of is not every scientist is a really good writer and gets that point across up front, especially in laboratory studies, because it's a mechanistic laboratory study and they aren't necessarily thinking about the implications for the lay public, because that's not their readership. You know, so it's up to the journalist to then translate that into general readership. And I guess that's why I feel like that's something where a lot of nuance can be lost, and which makes it more challenging for everybody.
What about the chemicals that seem to have effects at really, really small doses? And I'm talking here about the ones that seem to mimic or block hormones, which is something that toxicologists and epidemiologists have been dealing with since the early 90s. We've known about this, but a lot of the general public knows nothing about these hormone-altering chemicals. And what do we do with when people, it's just a tiny, tiny little dose in some cases.
So this is the issue of population risk, I think, versus individual risk. If, for example, you go to your doctor and they give you, say, your thyroid hormones, because sometimes that's measured in a standard thing, and they'll show you, here's the range for the normal public, and say the range goes from 1 to 20, and you've got a 2. And they'll say to you, not to worry, you're within the normal range. Well, you might want to say, is 1 to 20 the normal range for me? Or would my normal range really be 4 to 24, and I'm low? So that when you're kind of at the ends of what's called the normal range, it might be a call to you to say, this is something I should think about. So when you're looking at basic biology, what our hormones do is that's what maintains us who we are. That maintains our normal physiology. And, your hormones kind of are going to vary a little bit. But different people are going to be varying within different limits. So what might be bad for you might not bother somebody else who's kind of in the middle. And, if you get pushed outside your own normal range – that's when you can see effects happening. Or, for example, if a woman is pregnant and she has, you know, an embryo or a fetus developing within her, it may be a more sensitive time in life. So again, what's normal for one person may not be normal for another person, and very slight changes for someone who is more susceptible for one reason or another can, in fact, cause a problem. Did I help you with that, Marla?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, I'd like to open this up now to everyone. Wow, a lot of questions.
I subscribe to the Berkeley Wellness newsletter, and I would like somebody to make some comments. I find it an excellent source of refined information.
I love that newsletter. Does anyone else get it?
What's the name of it again?
The Berkeley Wellness.
They have actually, I think you should have more of these kinds of panels where you get more attendees to get this information proliferating throughout the culture.
Hi, my name is Janet Noodleman. I work for the Breast Cancer Fund here in San Francisco. And, you know, I just have to say I'm so thrilled at watching your faces as you listen to Dr. Birnbaum talk about toxicology. And all of us in the room are equally thrilled by your brilliance. And what I'm wondering is, you know, you're clearly a really small subset of the environmental health journalists out there. And as advocates, we desperately want other environmental health journalists to be as smart as you are. So where do they out there, those other journalists, get their toxicology training from?
Well, sometimes it feels like we're the only ones,
this
right?
This is us.
And,
you
know. And how do we get the rest of them as smart as you are?
Well, it takes good sources, people like Linda who will take the time and patience. We need scientists who will talk to us. Often scientists won't return our phone calls, don't feel comfortable talking to the press, but they really need to, because it's their only way they can reach the general public. And if they want their information, their science, to be relevant, they need to be able to explain it to people like me. I spent most of my career at newspapers. I was 20 years at the LA Times, newspapers before that. And newspapers are in dire straits, and they're worse than anything that you've probably heard. The LA Times lost half its staff. That's half its staff. I left voluntarily, and now I'm in Environmental Health News, and we're doing our own stories focusing on environmental health. We're trying to fill the gap and offering our stories to papers like the San Francisco Chronicle because of the lack of reporting out there. There's just hardly anybody at newspapers especially that are covering these types of issues. They just don't have the staff.
Well,
and,
and
in many cases, they don't have the interest either.
They also are increasingly lacking the experience.
Right.
Because when they jettisoned so many of our colleagues, it was over high salaries. Well, when you keep the newbies, they just don't have the experience level. If we do a good job, we didn't do a good job the first year or two we were out there. It took,
right.
We had a learning curve, a very steep learning curve. And I've been doing this for about 35 years. And our readers sort of will benefit from my doing this for 35 years. It's so much better than the first five.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And we have about 100 years experience here. That's
And there is some education going on. The Society of Environmental Journalists is very active, as you may know. And at the last annual conference, we had it in Miami, and Marla did an environmental health panel. And it was very crowded with journalists getting training. And I think they learn by reading stories very carefully to see how they're done, what kind of sources we use, how we put together the information, combining real people in the world with very good science, and how you tell that story. And you can learn by reading others. But again, as it gets back to who's going to pay for this?
Right. Most reporters don't want to take on these issues. As we said earlier, there's no black and white. There's a lot of gray area, and a lot of journalists don't like dealing with that at all. They
Nor
just
do
want
editors.
To write about somebody, you know, somebody who's guilty of corruption, and there's no doubt about it. Whereas everything we write has that gray area, and most reporters don't want to touch it.
I know it, right, there's a lot of questions in this room, but if I may just, if you can indulge me on one point here, because you hit a hot button. The journalism we grew up with, I think, followed what I call the political template of reporting. You might also call it the ping pong match, the he said, she said. There's no accident. I mean, a lot of your positions of leadership in the newsrooms were men and women who came up on the political beat or the sports beat, which is very much alike. And so here you have the environmental journalists that really have a lot of maybes in the story. And that makes a lot of editors squirm. So environmental journalists have been, by and large, misfits in newsrooms. That's been my experience. And it's been a battle because it's been alternately viewed as advocacy, although, of course, if you're a medical reporter, a health reporter, no one questions you, well, why are you covering these stories about health? You want better health, don't you? Or you want better schools, you cover schools. But it does, it's the advocacy label and or trendy, and it seems to be dispensable. So that is sort of the culture, and I think it's still there. It's improved, but again, we don't have the bodies out there.
Hi, this is Shannon Coughlin. I'm also from the Breast Cancer Fund, and this is a really rich discussion, and it's great to put faces with names of the journalists who we've been reading for years, and we count on your coverage, so thank you. My question is, we seem to have a regulatory model, especially at the federal level, that is certainly closer to certainty than precaution. And so a question for the journalists on that is, we're seeing a really ramp. We think we're seeing a ramping up of industry, especially chemical industry response. And one of the typical responses is, well, the FDA says it's fine, or the EPA doesn't see a problem with it. So if we have a regulatory model that's based on certainty and not precaution, how do you as journalists deal with that in terms of of needing your stories to feel balanced? And dealing with journalists, or dealing with industry response. And then my question for Dr. Birnbaum is, how do we start to move towards a regulatory model that's based on precaution?
When she's done, I'd like to talk about journalism.
Go ahead. I was going to address the industry. Do you want to take that one?
You do that, and I'll do the FDA.
One, two, punch.
Well, I mean, industry obviously has ramped up the pressure on these types of things. We have a law right now that regulates toxic compounds called the Toxic Substances Control Act. It's been around since 1976. It's generally known as a pretty weak law because EPA hasn't banned a chemical under it since asbestos in 1988.
And it didn't.
Or 88-89, and that was thrown out of court because there wasn't enough evidence against asbestos. So if you don't have enough evidence against asbestos, which clearly causes lung disease in a work setting, then what can you ban under that law? And so when industry says that, EPA calls it safe, it's like, well, EPA is not calling it safe, but they just don't have the strong enough laws to actually do much about it. Industry tactics, well, industry has legitimate points of view. We can talk about a chemical that you might not have an alternative for that is important for use in consumer products. And so that is a point that needs to come across in stories, that there are economic reasons for certain uses of chemicals. So you always have to include that in the story. I spent a lot of my career writing about air quality. You couldn't write about air quality without talking about, say, emissions standards for cars, and you have to talk to the auto industry about how can you engineer the car to do that? What's it going to cost? What are the side effects of it? I mean, you do have to interview industry for that. Of course, there's been lots of attention to some of the tactics used by some industries of doing its own science in some cases, and there's controversies about it, that science, and whether it was done right, especially with BPA. I mean, that one is very controversial. Some of the tactics of industry, the chemical industry, were ones they learned from the tobacco industry. They're using the same types of arguments as, you know, there's no cause and effect.
They even have some of the same lobbyists.
No, they had some of the same lobbyists. The names have been cropping up the same. So, I mean, there's obviously controversy about that. So there's certain stories about those types of tactics. But industry does have a point of view that's legitimate to include in every story you write about chemicals.
Jane.
Yes. You were talking about the FDA and some of the standards aren't strict enough. Well, as you know, the Food and Drug Administration has authority over commercially sold fish, and it's a number. No fish should be on the shelf if it has mercury exceeding one part per million. Well, every consumer survey that's done, they always find swordfish and other the big predator fish, lots of the big tuna out there that exceeds that, sometimes four parts per million, and nobody is really pulling it off the shelves. It's not enforced. But on the other hand, you've got the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, which is part of its responsibility, spent years establishing a so-called safety guideline or reference dose. And it's not really used at all in commercially sold fish. And so, for instance, if you had a 60-pound child eating albacore tuna 6 ounces a week, which is allowed, if that's the right verb, by the FDA, it would be three times as high as would be recommended under the EPA's reference dose, which is based on size, variety of fish, consumption, and so you've got quite a difference in enforcement in the U.S.
So, to answer your question about, first of all, you know, the agency that I run is part of the National Institutes of Health. We do basic research. We don't do regulations. That being said, we would like to see laws that took into account the newest science and the best science. The problem with some of the current testing that it's done is it's asking questions that were current 30 or 40 or 50 years ago. Science has moved on, and part of the problem with industry science is they're asking the questions that the regulators said you have to answer these questions 30 and 40 years ago, instead of asking the questions that we now know are important to ask. And I think that's some of the key issues that we have there.
I'd like to comment on that. I'd say, you know, one tool that you have is the law. And I can give you some examples. You know, the work we do, TSCA was already mentioned. So TSCA is a very chemical-centric, rather weak law, because it's all about producing a new chemical that is going to help the bottom line of some company. We do a lot of work under the Endangered Species Act. The Endangered Species Act is species-centric, and the regulations relating to that are very different. So we do science to support both of those kinds of things. Now, with the Endangered Species Act, we demonstrate that a chemical in the environment at very, very low concentration is potentially limiting the conservation and recovery of enlisted salmon up in Oregon or Washington or Northern California. That science can be taken. I mean, the fact is that in Washington and Oregon, we have NGO groups that used our science to change the state legislature, to bring lawsuit against EPA for failing to consult with NOAA on regulatory actions related to pesticides. The key to that was, because the science we do is regulatory science, we believe very strongly in outreach, and we work very hard with journalists. I mean, Janet here is someone that has written about our work on copper and salmon. So it was out there. We have tons of newspaper articles on it. The NGOs pick it up. They take it to the state legislature, or they take it to the Supreme Court in, if it's an ESA issue. So Washington banned copper from brake pads for the effects on salmon. Oregon followed, and I imagine it's probably, I don't know if any of you guys know, but I think in California it's probably under investigation in terms of that. But those are cases where citizens took the science. They had access to the science because the journalists and the scientists worked together to get it out there. So, I mean, it can be done.
But what you just said, John, is actually very important. What you said, the citizens work together kind of with the journalists. And that's what happens is in many times the marketplace does speak. So, for example, the removal of BPA from baby bottles really came about not only because of the science that was conducted, but was because consumers started saying, I don't want any BPA in my baby bottles. And last week, Campbell's Soup announced that they weren't going to seal their cans with epoxy that had BPA in it anymore. Okay? Why are they doing that? Because consumers are saying to them, you know, I want you to be like Trader Joe's. I don't want BPA in our cans anymore. And, I mean, I think that is a role that is facilitated by good coverage from the press, because the stuff that my folks publish or even that I publish, most of this never sees the light of day. You know, it's in some esoteric scientific journal, you know, that we all read to each other, you know, and are very proud about what we do. But we depend upon folks like this to get that information and get it out to you. So, you know, you, the public, so that you can do something about it. And the marketplace is often works much faster than the regulatory agenda. Many of our laws are very conflicting. They have very, very specific requirements about what you have to prove or not prove, or how many steps how many hurdles you have to jump. And so, frankly, if we can get people to take action, that can happen a lot more quickly than to actually have something happen in regulation.
And look at Europe. I don't know how. I mean, Europe is far more advanced in using the precautionary principle in a lot of their regulations. I don't know how that came about, but it's something to look at.
Next question.
I suspect that many of the panelists are familiar with the name John Ioannidis, mm-hmm. and I'm not sure I'm saying it properly. But anyhow, he's the fellow who in recent years has published in some of the major medical journals, particularly showing results that say that, and I'm without my information here, but I'm going to pick it out, and she certainly knows because she's smiling, that stuff that comes out today, 5 years from now, 30 to 50% of it will be shown to be not correct, that there was wrong sample size, that the report, that the research was done improperly. What does the panel, as one, the panel should be familiar with some of this. Two, how do you react to it?
First of all, I think it's an overstatement in many cases. I mean, repetition or some consistency in results is very important. You know, so I think when you see one paper that comes out that says the sky is falling, not too many people are running, you know, out to raise their hands to hold it up. But if you start seeing many papers coming out, you know, that all begin to achieve a common understanding, I think that's when the science starts building. Science, it's not sometimes that it's wrong. It's that we learn more things as we go forward so that we can learn that the explanation that we gave for whatever findings we saw, you know, was not correct. You know, science is more than just the data. It's the interpretation you bring to the data. And as you learn more, it can interpret things differently. I mean, I know I published a paper back in 1986, I thought it was a really great paper. You know, it got a lot of attention. It was an important paper. And about 10 years later, no, it was more than that, about 12 years later, I realized I was wrong. You know, because it turned out that I had basically ignored some of the findings in that paper because they just didn't make sense. Well, 12 years later, I understood what they were telling me, and they were important. So I don't think that it's like that scientists are wrong. It's just that science is a body of knowledge that continues to accrue more and more information. And as you learn more, you may change your interpretation of things.
Yeah, and you really have to be careful of the definition of wrong because it's exactly that. As you get more data, you reinterpret it, and hypotheses are proven true or false and modified and such. Now, what's truly wrong, and this is part what many people may not be familiar with in the politics of science, you know, the flashy stuff that comes out in the most high-profile journals that get cited the most often.
Fusion.
In there, you know, you get excited papers, and a year later there's a retraction, you know, because somebody falsified some data because they want to get a high-profile paper so they get a great job. You know, that's kind of the sort of cynical view of it. Those types of retractions, when you look at all the publications out there, are extremely rare. So, I mean, to have blatantly false stuff happen, there's a lot. That's what the peer review system is all about. And most of the good science is down in the lower tier journals, and I mean lower tier by flashy. You know, the flashy journals are like Science and Nature, right? Those are the two most widely cited journals. But most papers get published down in the subspecialty journals. And it's rare. It's modification of interpretation that happens over time. And some people would like to say, yeah, these guys are wrong because they're going back and saying, oh, actually, our hypothesis turned out to be incorrect. But that's not the same thing as